You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters. Hello, and welcome to the Table Talk podcast, where we explore a huge range of crucial issues and exciting developments in the food industry with brilliant guests drawn from all areas of expertise. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a TV presenter and a writer, and I specialize in food and science. Now, this podcast is all about the role of nutraceuticals and supplements in boosting immunity. Now, we're recording this in coronavirus lockdown, during which there's been a growing interest in supplements. So this podcast will look at what role nutraceuticals and supplements might play in boosting immunity and maybe the potential benefits they could bring. Is it an exciting world of potential, or is it a venal world of smoke mirrors and grubby, fear-based profiteering? Is conflicting advice damaging the public perception of nutrition expertise? And is there anything out there that actually works? Now, we have a frankly terrifying array of expertise on our panel to answer all of these questions. So let's meet them. We're joined by Professor Susan Lanham-New, Head of the Department of Nutritional Sciences at the University of Surrey.
Hello.
Professor Mairead Kiely, Professor of Human Nutrition, University College Cork.
Hello.
Professor Judy Buttress, Director General of the British Nutrition Foundation.
Hello.
And Rob Hobson, Registered Nutritionist, Consultant and Head of Nutrition at Healthspan.
Hi.
Now, let's start with Susan. Susan, can we just start by laying down some of the groundwork here? What do we mean by the immune system, and why is everyone talking about it now?
The immune system, which of course is integrated within all our physiological systems. So what I mean by that is the immune system protects our body against infections and other what we would call external and internal insults by a whole range of different processes, and in particular through different immunoglobulins, for example, our innate immunity. And of course, at this moment in time, when, you know, we're in a pandemic of a virus that is affecting the human body, of course, we are thinking about our immune system and our defense in fight against infections.
And the immune system is working all the time, isn't it? It's not just now that we need it. It's a complex system that is doing a huge variety of different things all the time.
That's absolutely right. It's a system that is continually from the moment we're born right up to, you know, at old age. It is exactly as you say, a continuous, you know, battle, if you like, of the body against the different insults that come in, whether that be, you know, the physical insults, the biochemical insults, and of course the antibodies and within that the immunoglobulins that we have, you know, right across the age span. But of course it's so much in everybody's minds because of, you know, COVID-19.
Absolutely. Now, I love the word insult as well. It sort of humanizes it in an extraordinary way. Now, Mairead, we talk a lot about boosting immunity, or rather it's talked about by people on sofas on television. Is immunity boostable?
The short answer is yes. So just building on what Sue said there, if we think about our immune defense against infection, and then the immune system is also working to defend us against, for instance, carcinogens and to prevent the spread of cancer. It's also working in our favor or against us, depending on our inflammatory profile in the development of cardiovascular disease and other diseases of aging. So immune function isn't just about our resistance to infection, it's about our response and our ability to handle a lot of chronic non-communicable diseases as well. So the short answer to your question is yes, we can boost immune function, and nutrition is one of the ways that our immune system can be either compromised or strengthened.
And you hinted a little bit there about another side of it, which is sort of the concept of allergies and the immune system fighting something that maybe it doesn't need to fight as well. So,
sure, yeah, and you know, autoimmune disorders such as, for instance, multiple sclerosis. But our knowledge of the role of nutrition in allergy and in something like autoimmune disorders is much less well developed than our knowledge of the role of nutrition in sort of non-communicable diseases or in immune defense. But having said that, Stefana, we need to acknowledge this. It's all very new science, and we don't know a hell of a lot more than we do know.
And now I'm getting exactly what you're talking about. So this is really interesting that we know a lot and yet we know a little at the same time. Now
we know a lot and we know very little at the same time. So we know that certain sectors of the population are at increased risk because they're deficient in certain nutrients. However, we don't know how much and the best routes to provide that additional nutritional support for those people. And something is happening which is really confusing the issue, which is that, for instance, viral transmission requires person-to-person contact. And once that transmission has taken place, it pretty much doesn't really matter what your nutritional status is, you will have acquired the virus. What we don't understand is whether your ability to withstand that viral acquisition is influenced by your nutritional status.
Yeah, and this is
and how you can handle the disease itself, you know, if it progresses.
Stefan, if I could just come back to what Mairead was saying there, which was absolutely that, you know, we have so many more questions than what we have answers, and that, yeah, you know, we have that innate immune system where we have our, you know, our physical barriers, you know, our skin, our GI tract, our respiratory tract, all of those aspects. Then you've got your defense mechanisms, which are of course your sort of secretions, your sweat, your saliva, and then you've got your general immune responses. But on the other side, you've got your, what we would call your acquired or your adaptive immune system. So like we have certain cells like your B cells or your T cells, and we just, yeah, we really don't have the evidence that we need. And I think to add to what Mairead said there, we have to apply the same rules in nutritional sciences as we do in every other science that we have, that we can really only base advice on where the evidence is sound and it's backed up, you know, by properly conducted research trials.
Yeah, and this is the absolute crux of this podcast. So Judith, in the light of the lack of knowledge in certain areas, and yet the explosion in the nutraceutical side of the food industry and the supplement industry, first of all, what do we mean by nutraceuticals? And are there tools that we can deploy, as the food industry and the supplements industry seems to be hinting at? Can we actually tackle this using the knowledge that we have at the moment?
Well, nutraceuticals is a word that's bandied around, and it probably means different things to different people. But I'm a nutritionist, and thinking about nutrition and diet, there is information that we already have about different various vitamins and minerals that have a role to play in the immune system. So a number of the B vitamins, vitamin C, vitamin D, we've already mentioned, and also some minerals such as iron, copper, zinc, selenium. And there are accepted health claims, official claims for each of those nutrients in relation to the immune system. And the important point to make is that there are a number of these nutrients that are involved. There may indeed be others, as also the omega-3 fatty acids, they seem to be important as well.
Do I get the slight sense that the word nutraceutical is an irritation?
Yeah, it's in my world, it's not that clearly defined. So we
and mine either.
I think the point I wanted to make is that these nutrients work together collaboratively. You know, possibly in small teams, but they're not sort of, there isn't a magic bullet that you can just take a single supplement of one thing and fix a problem if you have a low immune status. And so the best way to get these things is through a varied and balanced diet that is providing a whole range of different foods. And in some cases, there is evidence that supplements help as well. And that's the situation with vitamin D at the moment. many of us are not able to get outside as much as we would do normally. And the government has recently reissued its advice about the importance of supplements throughout the summer months when we'd normally be relying on sunshine to make sure that people are getting sufficient vitamin D. And in the UK, that's 10 micrograms per day. As my colleagues and I are well aware, there have been reports of really, really high advice on really, really high supplements. And really, there's no evidence to back that up.
Yeah. But what's really interesting is your phrase of the magic bullet. Now, Rob, you work with the food industry. Now, the phrase balanced diet doesn't flog a lot of kit, does it, down at the shops? What people really want is a magic bullet. Is that what all the food companies are looking for? Either something that sounds like a magic bullet or something that might be a magic bullet in order to produce something that will inspire the public?
I think that I can only talk for, I have worked with a lot of food companies and a lot of wellness brands, and there are people that take that approach. But I think what's important is that companies have a responsible attitude to their manufacturing and how they promote their products. You know, I can talk at Healthspan and one of the things we do, we've talked about boosting immunity, and what Sumerade, and actually I agree with Judith, have pointed out that even that phrase is used a lot to sell products. But you know, when you're thinking about the idea of boosting your immunity with a single food or single nutrient, it just doesn't make sense, because the system's so complex and not a single entity that can be influenced by this, especially high doses. So I think it's, like I said, I think it's about companies being responsible about how they promote their products and working with experts to try and help get the message across that food should come first. But there is a role for supplements, for instance. They just need to be taken wisely, in the right doses and for the right reason.
And so our academic panel, what do you think about the role of supplements? Has it been over-egged, or are they a useful tool that just needs to have the right message?
And all of us, you know, Mariah, Judy and I all work and have done for many, many years in what we would call public health nutrition. So that's, you know, really trying to work at the cutting edge of, you know, population health. And I think it is very fair to say that if somebody follows a balanced diet, there should be really no reason to take extra supplements. And I think for each, you know, for a number of different nutrients, we have to drill down and really see, you know, is there the scientific evidence to back that up? I think certainly, as Mariah and Judy have said, vitamin D, I think, stands out. It's not a vital amine. Let's not forget that phrase. Vitamins are vital amines. The amine is a chemically composed group, and they used to be exactly called that, a vital amine. And then we dropped the E off and they became vitamins. Vitamin D is a pro-hormone, and as Judy said, your main source is UV exposure. So that would be certainly one where we would want to avoid deficiency. And I think all of us would sit on that page to say we should be avoiding deficiency of different nutrients. Going then to the next level to say, you know, this would be for optimal health and for boosting your immune system, I think we would just all struggle that there isn't the scientific data out there on many of the claims that are made. And, you know, we have to follow, all of us as registered and accredited nutritionists, very tightly, you know, along that guidance of basing what we say on what the evidence is. Now, I think the other part to say on that, of course, when we run these different trials, we run, you know, these randomized controlled trials, such are times now that we are kept to very strict ethical committee guidelines of what we do. And so certainly, you know, Mariah, who's done a number of hugely important vitamin D randomized controlled trials, I'm certain will join me to say that it's now becoming quite difficult to run trials, quite rightly, ethically, on people who, you know, are baseline, have a baseline vitamin D deficiency, and then have a 50% chance of being on a placebo to look then at a health outcome. So I do appreciate that people say, well, the evidence, you know, you may or may not get in those trials, because the very people that you want to look at, you would have to exclude because of the ethical committee constraints. And I think it would just come back down to that we just have to be mindful and responsible in what we say and what we do, and where we absolutely can base it on the evidence. And if you look at that, and so many people say, oh, it's that old chestnut again, you know, the balance of good health plate, or the, you know, food pyramid as they use in the US. But actually, if you really decipher that down, you can get an awful lot of messages out there. You know, for example, 5 portions of fruits and vegetables per day. We are nowhere near that for this country, and many other countries too. If you could just change that bit in people's diets, you know, I'm certain that would go an awful long way, you know, to people's good health.
Yeah. So Mairead, the public don't really... Do you think the public doesn't really care about the evidence-based approach? They really want, you know, they want that magic bullet. They want a pill.
They want the magic bullet. No, Steph, the public don't want to hear about a balanced diet, because it just... they don't even know what it means anymore. And unfortunately, people want a magic bullet because that's what's been sold. And I want to just go back on something that Sue said first, just to clarify a couple of things. There are subgroups of the population that absolutely need supplements. So, you know, women who are sexually active and capable of becoming pregnant should be taking folic acid. That goes without saying. And we don't have a folic acid fortification policy yet in your country or in mine, so that everyone should be taking folic acid if there's a possibility that they might become pregnant. The other thing is that vegans need to take B12. So I'm just going to put those two out there as absolutes. Vitamin D is now also an absolute. Everyone should be taking 10 micrograms per day. And we know that higher doses are safe, but not necessarily recommended based on the evidence. Vitamin A is a massive nutritional deficiency worldwide, very involved in immunity. There are cases. WHO has run really, really successful fortification programs for vitamin A. It has had, you know, huge global effects. So there are cases where a focus on a specific nutrient, but it has to be a population-based approach. So if we go back to your question specifically, people want a magic bullet because everybody, whether it is, you know, medical professionals and the public, are focused on a drug which will solve the problem. And this is why I personally don't like the term nutraceuticals, because nutrients are not drugs. Nutrients do not cure problems that are not caused by nutritional deficiency. So if you take the example, if we go to the example of vitamin C, and I love using vitamin C as an example with classes, because when I was a student, I'm not going to tell you how long ago that was, but it was a long time ago, we were told that the RDA, which is the recommended dietary amount for vitamin C, was 30 milligrams a day. And this was to prevent scurvy. And now the recommended dietary allowance for vitamin C is between 90 to 120 milligrams per day. Some countries even have a little bit of an allowance in there for people who smoke. And that's because the science has progressed. We still don't know anything about vitamin C, but we know a hell of a lot. But we also know that it's very, very little absorbed above 250 milligrams in the day. Now, Sue just said, if you take your 5 fruit and vegetables, and I guarantee you, if you take 5 fruit and vegetables, and they're all different, and they don't contain potatoes, by the way, you'll get to 250 milligrams of vitamin C in your diet alone. Therefore, there's no need for a vitamin C supplement in excess of 250 milligrams per day. And as I tell students, what you're making is, you know, quite expensive wee-wees right there, because you're not absorbing anything above that, or at least not efficiently. So, I mean, that's why people love to take a drug that makes them feel better, and they want to take a nutrient that's going to, you know, cure their disease, but nutrients don't cure diseases. Mm.
So, okay, Rob, the issue we've got here is that the basic, decent nutritional advice isn't sexy. The balanced diet, I think... the vast majority of people have been told this at least 100 times at some level. They haven't taken it in necessarily. They just don't really care. What do you think this is why there is such a role for nutraceuticals and supplements?
Yeah, I've actually never used the word nutraceuticals. I've always just stuck to supplements. But yeah, I guess so. I mean, you know, a healthy balanced diet can actually be sexy if you know good ways to cook food and interesting ways to cook food. And I think that whatever we say has to support this guidance. But yeah, I do think there is, I think there is a role for supplements. I think there are other groups. I think that a lot of people start, not everybody eats a perfect diet all of the time. And I think behaviour change is really difficult. It's hard to get people to eat well, whether they are interested in health or whether they're not interested in health. And I do think there is a role for supplements to support people's diets alongside them trying to make the changes to the way they eat. You know, I'm always quite concerned about teenage girls. I think they're a population, if you look at the NDNS survey, who don't have the best diets. You know, 50% have low intakes, insufficient intakes of iron. We've got magnesium is a problem. We've got iodine, all those and other such nutrients. So I think in certain cases like that, then I think a supplement might be useful for that group. But alongside reinforcing the healthy eating message, if that's possible, it's quite a fine line. And I understand that when you're talking about public health, my background is actually public health. But when you're talking about public health, you don't want to be telling people to take supplements. But I think in some instances, I just don't think they're such a bad thing.
I think as a nutrition scientist, we're, you know, we've all got a nutrition background on this interview. And I think we have a duty to try and help the public see healthy diet advice as the way forward and try and make it more sexy in the way we put it over, because we mustn't forget that the dietary guidelines that exist in countries around the world have actually been developed in order to achieve the full set of nutrients that we know are essential for health. There's, you know, 30, well, lots of different vitamins and minerals, lots of different types of components of protein and of fat and so forth. And the it's interesting that countries around the world have come out with pretty much the same sorts of recommendations. So about around oily fish and fruit and vegetables and whole grains and so forth. And so, you know, in the background, if we could just persuade people to move a little bit from where the current diets are towards the sorts of diets which are depicted in the UK in the Eat Well Guide, then we know that that would cover off most of their nutritional requirements without them having to worry about whether they've had enough of this nutrient or that nutrient. And so I think we do have a duty as nutritionists to try to do that. As my colleagues have said, there are one or two nutrients that we know that some groups will require a supplement, and folic acid in women is a really good example. And so that has to be a sort of modification of the mantra of you can get everything you need from your diet. Some groups do need extra nutrients. But I think that going back to a point I made before is that many of the nutrients that we require for health don't work in isolation. They work together with other nutrients to have their effect. And so, I did my PhD many, many moons ago on vitamin C, and I was looking at the impact of large doses of vitamin C on the body at the time. And that really brought it home to me that you can have too much of a good thing, and that if you are having a very large amount of a single micronutrient, it can actually inhibit your ability to absorb other things which may be not present in your diet in sufficient quantities. And we've already heard about the problems that we're facing with the diets of young people, particularly young girls in the UK, with many of them having intakes of a whole raft of micronutrients, which are probably not as good for them as they ought to be. You know, they should be having more of those nutrients. And the best way to help people move to a place where they're getting a good amount of a whole spread of things, in my view, is to do it through food rather than through one or two different supplements. You know, if people are concerned that they're not getting enough from food, then the first step is to consider one of the multivitamin and mineral supplements, which have just got relatively low amounts of a whole range of different things that we need in the right sorts of proportions. And that, you know, if people are feeling a bit run down, then that's a good, probably temporary measure. And these things are not particularly expensive. Just because some supplements cost a lot of money is not going to mean they're better for you. So that is sort of a backstop to a multivitamin and mineral supplement. But so return to the point that really it's about getting people eating better, eating more healthily, because that's the way that they will, in the longer term, be in a better position to assure their health.
Yeah. Now let's do a little bit of BNF navel gazing for a second, Judy. All five of us here on this podcast are desperate for the public to eat better, and yet they're turning to nutraceuticals. Let's use that word, and supplements. You know, the balanced diet is not getting through to the vast majority of people. What are we doing wrong, and what should we do to solve the problem?
So first, I'm not sure that everybody is turning to supplements. I mean, the evidence from the dietary surveys in this country suggests that quite a low proportion of people take supplements compared with other countries. And that may well be why we've got a low vitamin D status in the UK compared with other parts of Europe, where supplements are much more commonly taken. But going back to, you know, what do we need to do? We need to make it fun. At BNF, you mentioned BNF. At BNF, we do a lot of work with schools, often based around the Eat Well Guide, and helping kids put the messages that sit behind that fairly simple image into practice, helping them to understand how to look at their diet, look at a diet record, and see whether they've got the right balance of foods. And we've got quite a number of games and so forth on the site. And during this lockdown period, we've created a special hub for lockdown learning for children and their families. And that's proved really, really popular. We've made our online courses free to access. And again, we've had very large numbers of people visiting the site. So there is an interest in nutrition. We just have to make it fun.
First of all, the magnesium one that you brought up, Robert, I think it's important that for some nutrients, and magnesium is one of them, that actually the RNI, the reference nutrient intake, and the LRNI is actually set too high. And that is being looked at the moment, because if you look at, you know, nutrients across the board, but particularly in our younger populations, it always comes up very high with magnesium. And what makes it very difficult, not just for that one micronutrient, but others, is trying to define what are the requirements. Because for some nutrients, we don't have very good markers of status. So for vitamin D, for example, we do 25-OHD, 25 hydroxy vitamin D. You measure that in blood, and that gives you an indicator of status. Whereas something like magnesium, red cell magnesium or serum magnesium, are not good indicators of bodily stores. So from that perspective, Stefan, I think nutritional sciences is a hugely so much more complex than what people think. I would also add to that, on social media, we have a lot of people purporting on their fad diets, a whole range of different things. Indeed, 2 years ago, I helped the Royal Osteoporosis Society with their clean eating. So basically what that is, there's been a lot that's been said about clean eating. And one of the aspects of that is young people, particularly teenage girls and boys, completely cutting out all dairy, with no efforts or no guidance from social media gurus to really talk about that. If you exclude one whole food group from that food plate, you've got to make efforts to replace it with other foods. So, for example, soya milk most soya milks are fortified with calcium, and it's just as well absorbed as cow's milk. So that is, you know, that is really critical. I think also from a perspective, and the BNF, of course, have done their hugely successful for so many years, their Healthy Eating Week. And we now have in schools the GCSE in food technology, where young people can really plant the seed of their interest a few years ago, the A-level in food technology, which would have been a great follow-up to that, got cut. And so people, and that is something that an organisations, particularly the BNF, are really trying to get back onto the agenda, because it's only by educating young people, and that was such a good route, doing, you know, a GCSE and then following on with a food technology A level, whereas now we no longer have that A level, and we're, you know, going to try and get that reversed, but it's not going to be something that comes back quickly. And so a lot of young people, all they do is that they learn about nutritional sciences on social media. And let me be provocative, as I was live on the Today program for 2 minutes a couple of years ago, most health social media gurus really don't know what they're talking about when it comes to nutritional sciences. And so, you know, it's all within that. And as Judy so rightly said, that if we could just improve people's diets, it would have such a huge impact.
Sue, I think actually another interesting point there, going on what Sue said, is I also don't think there are enough people on social media qualified experts. And I think we should be encouraging registered nutritionists and dietitians to have a stronger voice, because the companies I work with, we're moving away from Instagrammers because of this fact and the messages they're delivering and the influence they're having on young people. Well, actually, not just young people, all people, actually. So I do think there is room. And I think, like I said, all nutritionists and dietitians should have a voice on those platforms. Otherwise, we're kind of missing a trick, really. This is where people are listening to the information. So
they are. And when I said that very controversially, and I remember Sarah Montague looking at me and raising her eyebrows as if to say, blimey, you've hit the button there. And the Jeremy Vine producer asked me to go on his show live to debate with a health social media guru. And my reply was, bring them all on, let's have a debate. And not a single one would come on and debate it with me.
Okay. Now let's just shift the focus a little bit here. Mairead, if you could talk to the food industry, because the vast majority of people listening to this podcast will be in the food industry itself, what would you like to say to them? How should the food industry respond and support different ways of helping to boost immunity themselves? What can be done, do you think?
I think it's a really big ask for the food industry. The food industry are struggling to keep their businesses operational at the moment. But just before you asked me that question, I was listening to Sue and I was thinking, I really think, and I've begun to think much more over the last 3 years or 4 years around the food industry and the nutrition. The way I'm putting it together as a phrase, I would call it the agri-food nutrition industry. We need to think of it as a continuum. We need to stop creating barriers between the nutrition community, the food industry, and the agri-food producer industry, and have nutrition going from the very, very beginning in some of the ways that, you know, some of us have been working on, and you know, for instance, in the area of biofortification, where you can improve the nutritional value of crops as they're being produced, you can improve the nutritional value of muscle foods through animal nutrition, moving all the way through then through the food production side and involving more nutrition input into the quality of the foods that are being produced, the fat composition, the dietary fiber content, the whole grain content, the vitamin and mineral content. We're going to have to start thinking about this really seriously from the climate change perspective as well as human health, because we're going to have to start packing more nutritional value into each 100 calories that we consume. There are different subgroups in our communities, and it's just simply, we're going to have to acknowledge this as well, and I think it's a huge challenge for us. We're going to have to acknowledge that there are subgroups in our community who find it really hard to meet their dietary guidelines. So, for instance, if you're a 5'3" woman in a sedentary job who travels to work in her car or by public transport, i.e. not walking or cycling, you would probably have a total calorie budget for the day in and around 1800 calories and no more, to be quite honest. And it's really hard to meet your nutritional guidelines within that budget unless you completely exclude all of the non-essential calories. And by that I mean no Bicky sweets, cakes, alcohol, nothing in the crisps line or any of the treat foods that we commonly consume.
And you've just removed all the fun from a diet, I guess.
But that's the perception that we have. We think, oh, but I deserve a treat. And your treat might be 350 calories, but actually you're taking up a fifth of your daily budget. If you're a small person in a sedentary job, if you're, you know, if you're a child, an elderly person who mightn't be absorbing their nutrients as well as they did, like meeting your daily nutritional requirement within the envelope of the daily diet is getting increasingly challenging for people. So that's where I think the food industry can play a role, hand in hand with the nutrition sector, to start making better quality food, you know. And then we have to think about, are we prepared to pay a little bit more for that? Are we prepared to put a tiny little bit extra
and there comes the tricky really bit.
These are the big questions I think we need to start looking at now, and we need to work more closely with the food industry as well on that.
So I absolutely agree with what Mary's just said, and we mustn't forget that the majority of food businesses actually employ qualified nutritionists registered in order to help guide their strategy, and they do a great job in making sure that the businesses are reminded of the evidence base that we've all been talking about.
Okay, now we are going to have to draw this to a close now. We've run out of time. We could carry on with this conversation just forever, and I hope that we'll come back to it as well. So I'd just like to ask with one very quick question to everybody, and that is, what do you personally do to help boost your own immune system? So what is there, something that you eat, something you don't eat, or something that you do? Susan, could we start with you?
Certainly can. Mine would be a whole approach, a holistic approach to that. We've talked all about nutrition, but that's one side of the energy balance equation. The other side is, of course, physical activity. And so it's got to be a combination of, you know, eating according to that Eat Well guide with at least 5 fruits and portions of fruits and vegetables, and exercising. And, you know, I think the problems that we have with overweight and obesity in this country in population groups is as much to do, if indeed not more, with physical inactivity than it is to do with food excess.
Yeah. Okay. Mairead, what's your personal tool for keeping your immune system boosted?
Oh, mine is really basic. I eat everything. There's nothing excluded from the diet. There's a few things I don't like, and so I eat everything that I like. But I would watch, I would try and be, as one of those fairly small in stature people with a sedentary job, I would fairly watch the treat foods as well, and just try, you know, because obesity is a major factor here. And there's been a lot of work on, you know, the role of obesity in immune function. Certainly people who are obese seem to be suffering more from the current pandemic. So keeping an eye on the calories, that's what obesity is about. And just taking as much exercise as I can an hour a day doing something.
Very good. You're all very well behaved so far. Judy, what's your personal tool for helping your immune system?
So varied diet. So eating lots and lots of different things, making sure that the things I'm picking are effectively coming from the different food groups. But because I've been doing this for so many decades now, it's sort of inbuilt, I suppose. Making sure that I don't have too many foods that are providing lots of calories and not much else. So several of us have talked about sort of nutrient density in different ways. So making sure that the foods that I'm picking are packing lots of different nutrients. Mm-hmm. Dietary fiber, another thing that we've not mentioned, but a lot of us don't get enough of. And of course, activity. I love walking, so walk as much as I can. Although my job is sedentary, I try and do as much walking, getting to and from it. Either side of the commute, getting out in the fresh air and making some vitamin D.
Very good. You're all very well behaved so far. Rob, what about you?
I think eating a balanced diet is a no-brainer. For me, it's about other aspects of my life. So probably managing stress and sleep, I think, is probably the two things I focus on the most, because I don't sleep much and I get quite stressed.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Very good. Okay. Well, that's fantastic. Now, I know that we're going to be coming back to this subject in the future many, many times, and I hope that you'll all join us again to find out how it's all evolving. Now, you've been listening to the Tabletop Podcast from Food Matters with Professor Susan Lanham-New, Professor Mairead Kiely, Professor Judy Buttress, and Rob Hobson, and me, Stephen Gates. If you enjoyed this episode, you might like one of our other podcasts in which we explore, well, pretty much every aspect of the food industry, from fat salmon farm sustainability to gut microbiome analysis. Now, subscribe to get every episode fresh delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, take a look at foodmatters.co.uk. Goodbye. You've been listening to the Table Talk Podcast, brought to you by Food Matters. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, please visit foodmatters.co.uk.